In studying Mark's Gospel, we've got to deal with the last 12 verses and that controversy. Now, of course, this isn't a class on textual criticism, and we don't want to get all technical here, although some of the things that I'm going to say and some of the things I'm going to read may sound to you pretty difficult and technical. I'm going to try and keep it as simple as I can, but it is really important that we understand what the views are, because many commentaries today that are issued don't even comment on the last 12 verses of Mark. It's like the majority of scholarship has just forgotten about them. And this is very unfortunate and tragic. Now, to start off, I'm going to quote Blomberg from pages 74 and 75 of the textbook. He kind of sets it up from the critic's viewpoint pretty well for us. The longer ending of Mark 16:9-20 is almost certainly not what Mark wrote. The two oldest and most reliable complete copies of the Gospel do not contain it, Codexes Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. The style is quite different from the rest of Mark's Gospel, and some of the theology is potentially both heretical and fatal. See verse 18. These verses themselves contain an inordinately large number of textual variants, and several manuscripts reveal still other alternate endings. Either the original ending of Mark was lost, or the author deliberately ended abruptly with verse 8. Either way, early scribes tried to compensate for the abruptness by giving the gospel a quote-unquote proper ending. End quote. Notice here that Blomberg is pretty vague. He says that the two oldest and most reliable, as he says, manuscripts, codices Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. Now, Sinaiticus is designated Aleph, and Vaticanus is designated B. So when someone talks about Codex Aleph, which of course is the first letter in the Hebrew alphabet, looks like an X, but just a stylish one, and Vaticanus is B, when you hear Aleph and B, you're talking about Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus. Secondly, notice that he has a comment on what he believes is wrong with the theology of the last verses, particularly in verse 18. Well, we'll look at that. Then he says there's an inordinately large amount of textual variance. And then there are some alternate endings. And then he tries to say, well, if Mark 16:9-20 shouldn't be there, then you're left with two propositions. Either you are to believe that we've lost the ending of Mark's gospel, or you are to believe that that's deliberately the way the Holy Spirit wanted Mark to end it. So you're left with one of those two things. Now, the majority of conservative scholarship today believes that Mark deliberately ended abruptly with verse 8, and they were afraid. But a lot of former scholarship and a lot of critical scholarship just says that Mark either left his gospel unfinished or the last part was lost to us. Either way, if you take that hypothesis that the last part was lost or Mark didn't finish, then I believe that impugns the character of God. Impugns the character of God and giving us a gospel that's unfinished, or it impugns the character of God by giving us a gospel that he didn't preserve, at least all of it. If you believe that Mark ended abruptly with verse 8, then you have to explain why somebody would finish their gospel, particularly when he's reaching a high note with the passion and revealing who Jesus is, with the words, "and they were afraid." So, in order to explore this, I should first tell you that I believe that these last 12 verses are genuine, written by Mark, and that I believe that it's modern views of textual criticism that are to fault for their exclusion. Now, I'm going to use, to help give me the critic's viewpoint, Ralph P. Martin's New Testament Foundations, Volume 1, reading here from page 218 and going on to something in 219. Martin says this, in the first place, verses 9 through 20 are omitted by Aleph, B, the Sinaitic Syriac manuscript, and most manuscripts of the Armenian versions. They would be quite a few centuries later. And Eusebius and Jerome are witnesses that the best manuscripts of his day ended at verse 8a. Second, a shorter ending, printed in the RSV and the NEB, two versions, is attested along with the Textus Receptus in manuscript L, Sigma, 579, the Sahidic, that's a Egyptian document, the Ethiopian version, the Harclean Syriac, that's another Syriac manuscript, and the earliest Boheric manuscripts, that's again ancient Egyptian version, while in K, Bobbiensis, that's an early Latin manuscript, the shorter text stands alone. A third ending is given by W, which adds, in addition to verses 9 through 20, an extra interpolation after verse 14. So you just have a little bit extra. It's not really another ending. It's just a little bit that's added to verse 14 in one manuscript. Fourth, says Martin, a 10th century Armenian version, which ascribes verses 9 through 20 to the presbyter Ariston, is too late to be of any value, although F.C. Conybeare professed great respect for this attribution. This attribution is taken by C.S.C. Williams to be possibly no more than a guess based on the Arminian version of a well-known passage in Eusebius, which refers to the presbyters Aristion and John. Now, what that's got to do with the end of the Gospel, I'm not sure, but that's a reason that he gives, so I'm giving it to you. Then he continues, the longer ending, which is printed in the King James Version, was apparently known to Tatian, circa 170. It is found in a preponderant number of manuscripts, and he gives a good representation of them. It has been suggested that Justin Martyr, that is, circa 140, is the author of this longer recension. Von Soden thought so, but that's been refuted. Whether this attribution is correct or not, it is clear that the longer ending was written in the first half of the second century. But it is equally clear that it did not come from the pen of Mark. Several minuscules mark it with an asterisk to show that it was suspect. Moreover, the verses are under suspicion on lexical and stylistic grounds, for both their vocabulary and style are noticeably different from the rest of the Gospel. The description of Mary in 16:9 confirms this suspicion, for that verse apparently overlooks the earlier reference to her in 16:1. Well, we'll look at that. Verses 9 through 20 seem to be made up of material taken from other Gospels, and this fact too endorses the supposition that the longer ending is an editorial compilation. So that's Ralph P. Martin giving you an overview of the evidence for the critical side. Now, he's the most detailed that I could find. Carson and Moo are not as detailed. The entry in the Dictionary of Christ and the Apostles is not as detailed. Blomberg is not as detailed. And many other New Testament introductions and commentaries are not as detailed. Now, just to add on top of that, Bruce Metzger's textual commentary on the Greek New Testament, just in case you thought I didn't have it, this is basically used by Carson and Moo in their reporting of this. And Metzger here basically says the same thing as Martin. He does notice on page 123 that Clement of Alexandria and Origen show no knowledge of the existence of these verses. Furthermore, Eusebius and Jerome attest that the passage was absent from almost all Greek copies of Mark known to them. Again, the reason that I'm saying this is because when we come to the refutation, it's important for you to understand what's being said and then what actually is the truth. Remember that he said that Clement of Alexandria and Origen show no knowledge of the existence of these verses. Now, basically what he's saying here is not that they say that the verses are not there, it's just they don't quote them. And he says Eusebius and Jerome attest that the passage was absent from almost all Greek copies of Mark known to them. Okay, so that's basically the position that we're at when it comes to these last 12 verses. Now, there are supporters of the inclusion of the last 12 verses that very often you're not told about. The most important of these is Dean John Burgon, B-U-R-G-O-N, and his book, The Last 12 Verses of Mark. This book was originally published back in the 19th century. I think the original publishing date here was in the 1860s. Looking through my copy, which is reproduced by Sovereign Grace Publishers. But this was back in the 1860s that he wrote about this. Now, Burgon was one of the great New Testament textual critics of the 19th century. He was reckoned that way by even his enemies, and was a very, very thorough scholar. Burgon was the kind of guy who, if you told him something, he would go and check you out to see if you were telling the truth. He was a noted expert on early citations, both by patristic scholars and by early lectionaries, which are orders of service to be read in early church worship meetings, as well as early manuscripts, and in fact identified many early manuscripts himself. Burgon managed to see Codex Vaticanus and to review it, and I think he also saw Codex Sinaiticus and many of the other manuscripts that are mentioned. Burgon's book, The Last 12 Verses of Mark, is close to 400 pages long. Now, Martin, I quoted 2 pages. Blomberg has half a page. Carson and Moo have about a page. And Metzger has about 2 pages. Burgon has nearly 400 pages. And Burgon has hundreds of footnotes and lots of technical material. If you're familiar with Burgon, you will know that. So Burgon is certainly somebody who needs to be reckoned with. Also, one of the great textual critics of the last century, Frederick Scrivener, who wrote the plain introduction to New Testament textual criticism, believed in the last 12 verses of Mark. William Farmer believed that they should probably be there. Richard Lenski, the famous commentator, believed they should be there. James Morrison, in his commentary, a 19th century preacher in Scotland, argues for them at length. Edward F. Hills holds to them in his book, The King James Version Defended. J. Sidlow Baxter, the Bible teacher, holds to them. And the famous American New Testament scholar, J. A. Broadus, argues for them as well. D. Edmund Hebert, in his New Testament introduction, and I believe in his commentary on Mark, argues that they may well be part of it. And then the German scholar Zahn, even though he believed they were not part of the original, believed that they should be kept in there because they were of such early attestation. So let's look at some of these issues that the critics of the last 12 verses have put down, and let's try to at least address them briefly. In order to get any true satisfaction in answering this question, you're going to have to get Burgon's book. Yes, it's over 100 years old, but you will quickly see that he addresses all of the issues that are raised by modern scholars. And the modern papyri, modern manuscripts that have been found, have not changed the force of Burgon's arguments. It's just that people don't read them anymore, they ignore him. On the omissions in the 2 supposed best codices, Codex B and Aleph, the first thing that we should say is that you can't just sweepingly say that Codex B and Codex Aleph are the most reliable. This term reliable is a very subjective term. What these individuals mean by reliable is that they match up with the chosen text form, that is the Alexandrian text form, that they believe is superior. And that belief in the superiority of the Alexandrian text form comes from a methodology borrowed from, if you hadn't guessed, the Enlightenment, and from the same scholars that gave us the synoptic problem, Lachmann and Griesbach and others. And this methodology favors strongly the Alexandrian text, of which Vaticanus and Sinaiticus are examples. Vaticanus and Sinaiticus are 4th century Greek manuscripts, originating around about 340 AD. Notice that, they're 4th century. Now, some of the people that Bergen is going to quote are a few hundred years before that, and are known to be reliable sources. Also, we should say, and this is often overlooked, that B and Aleph are written in classical, that is, Attic Greek, not in Koine Greek. So whoever penned these documents, and they're written on vellum, very expensive writing material, very ornately written, whoever did that believed that the Gospels were kind of crude in their Koine form and they needed to be updated into the classical form. Also, they have many omissions in them, not just the omissions in the last 12 verses of Mark. In fact, in the 1970s and early 1980s, the omissions that we found in B and Aleph were the reason why so many readings were taken out of the Gospels, well, in fact, the entire New Testament, in the versions that were issued back then. If you get an NIV or a New American Standard version, or if you read Greek, if you get the 21st or 23rd editions of the Nestle Allen text, upon which those versions were based, you will find many readings taken out of them, which have since been put back into the versions and back into the Nestle Allen text. And the reason for this is because people were following B and Aleph and their omissions and not considering more documents. As more papyri came forward, these verses were put back in. But still, there is this belief taught by most seminaries and in most commentaries and commentators that these codexes are the most reliable. Well, Bergen didn't think so. Scrivener didn't think so. And there are still many people out there that at least question them. They're valuable codices, they shouldn't be thrown out, but they shouldn't be treated as some kind of manuscript royal family either. Okay, turning to Bergen then on this issue, he says at the end of his book here, on page 325, quote, "And yet it is notorious that very soon after the apostolic age, liberties precisely of this kind," that is, taking things out, "were freely taken with the text of the New Testament. Origen, AD 185 to 254, complains of the licentious tampering with the scriptures which prevailed in his day. Quote, "Men add to them," he says, "or leave out as seems good to themselves," end quote. Dionysius of Corinth, yet earlier, AD 168 to 176, this is the 2nd century, remarks that it was no wonder his own writings were added to and taken from, seeing that men presumed to deprave the word of God in the same manner. Irenaeus, his contemporary, living within 70 years of St. John's death, complains of a corrupted text. He also shows us that Revelation 22, 18 and 19 should be taken into account in this as well. And Bergen continues on page 326, "We are able to go back yet half a century and the deprivations of Holy Writ become avowed and flagrant. A competent authority has declared it, quote, no less true to fact than paradoxical in sound, that the worst corruptions to which the New Testament has ever been subjected originated within 100 years after it was composed," end quote. That's, by the way, a quotation from Scrivener. "Above all," Bergen continues, "it is demonstrable that Codex B and Codex Aleph abound in unwarrantable omissions, very like the present omissions. Omissions which only do not provoke the same amount of attention because they are of less moment. One such extraordinary deprivation of the text, in which they also stand alone among manuscripts, and to which their patrons are observed to appeal with triumphant complacency, has been already made the subject of distinct investigation. I am much mistaken if it has not been shown in my 7th chapter that the omission of the words en epheso in Ephesians 1:1 is just as unauthorized, quite as serious a blemish as the suppression of St. Mark 16:9-20. The words in Ephesus, by the way, are taken from those manuscripts. First of all, then, we need to notice that Bergen has shown, quoting fathers who were before Codex Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, in fact, over 150 years, that there was great manuscript corruption going on in the early centuries. And so that should put a textual critic on their guard. Now, very often, unfortunately, if you read books on textual criticism, I've read about 15 of them, you will find that not much emphasis is placed upon that fact that they don't seem to want to look at. Further on in his book, on pages 328 and 329, again having to do with the omissions in B and Aleph, Bergen says this: "We have indirect yet convincing testimony that the oldest copies of all did contain the verses in question. While so far are any of the writers just now enumerated from recording that these verses were absent from the early copies, that 5 out of those 10 fathers actually quote or else refer to the verses in question in a way which shows that in their day they were the recognized termination of St. Mark's Gospel." And then he says, "The facts which now meet us on the very threshold are in a manner conclusive. For if Papias and Justin Martyr, AD 150, do not refer to, yet certainly Irenaeus, AD 185, and Hippolytus, AD 190 to 227, distinctly quote 6 out of the 12 suspected verses, which are also met with in the 2 oldest Syriac versions, as well as in the Old Latin translation. Now, the latest of these authorities is earlier by a full 100 years than the earliest record that the verses in question were ever absent from ancient manuscripts. And the 8th Council of Carthage, as Cyprian relates, AD 256, Vincentius of Tiberi, one of the 87 African bishops were assembled, quoted the 17th verse in the presence of the council. Nor is this all. Besides the Gothic and Egyptian versions in the 4th century, besides Ambrose, Cyril of Alexandria, Jerome, and Augustine in the 5th, to say nothing of Codices A and C, the lectionary of the Church Universal, probably from the 2nd century of our era, is found to bestow its solemn and emphatic sanction on every one of these 12 verses. They are met with in every manuscript of the Gospels in existence, uncial and cursive, except 2. They are found in every version, and are contained besides in every known lectionary, where they are appointed to be read at Easter on Ascension Day." Now, yes, there's been a couple of manuscripts that have come up since that time that have omitted them, but I hope that you understand that Bergen is giving you a welter of evidence, not just from manuscripts, but from church fathers and from lectionaries and from versions from different parts of the ancient Roman Empire, that these verses should be there. And you can see the kind of scholarship that is behind what he's saying. It's not like you find in Blomberg, where you just got generalisms. He's giving you the people, and he's giving you in footnotes the places where you can find them. When it comes to these omissions, then, I think Bergen has the better of the argument. But he says on 330, just to continue here, "On the other hand, the express statement of Victor of Antioch, AD 450, that he knew of the mutilation, but had ascertained by critical research the genuineness of this section of scripture and had adopted the text of the authentic Palestinian copy, is more than enough to outweigh the faint presumption created, as some might think, by the words of Eusebius that his own copy was without it." So here's a guy in the 5th century AD, Victor of Antioch, who actually investigates whether the last 12 verses should be there or not. And Bergen says, "As a plain matter of fact, the sum of the patristic evidence against these verses is the hypothetical suggestion of Eusebius already quoted. And, of course, this is what you find in Martin and in Metzger. They talk about Eusebius, saying that these verses shouldn't be there. Let's move, therefore, to this testimony of Eusebius. To do that, we're going to go earlier in the book to page 128, where Bergen has a whole chapter on this very thing. I'm not going to read you the whole chapter, just a little quotation from it. Now, by the way, the first thing that Bergen does is Bergen gives you the entire quotation from Eusebius, so you can see what Eusebius actually says. Then he says this on page 128. Here are two readings, he says, as is so often the case elsewhere, both of which are to be received, inasmuch as by the faithful and pious this reading is not held to be genuine rather than that, nor that than this, end quote. And thus we seem to be presented with the actual opinion of Eusebius, as far as it can be ascertained from the present passage, if indeed he is to be thought here to offer any personal opinion on the subject at all, which, for my part, I entirely doubt. But whether we are at liberty to infer the actual sentiments of this father from anything here delivered or not, quite certain, at least, is it that to print only the first half of the passage, as Tischendorf and Tregelles have done, and then to give the reader to understand that he is reading the adverse testimony of Eusebius as to the genuineness of the end of St. Mark's Gospel, is nothing else but to misrepresent the facts of the case. Now, what he has done before is that he has given the entire text of Eusebius' view, and then he has said that the author, I'm quoting from Bergen, the author of the exaggeration under review, and that exaggeration is reproduced by Metzger, that evidently Eusebius didn't have these verses in the copies that he used. He says, the author of the exaggeration under review, be it observed, is clearly not Eusebius. It is evident that he has nothing to say against the genuineness of the conclusion of St. Mark's Gospels. In fact, what Eusebius is doing is he's saying that some people say this, but Eusebius himself seems to say that both the ending of Mark's Gospel and the ending of Matthew's Gospel are to be received as being authentic. Now, on page 129, Bergen says, let it be freely conceded, but in fact it has been freely conceded already, that there must have existed in the time of Eusebius many copies of St. Mark's Gospel which were without the 12 concluding verses. I do but insist that there is nothing whatever in that circumstance to lead us to entertain one serious doubt as to the genuineness of these verses. I am but concerned to maintain that there is nothing whatever in the evidence which has hitherto come before us, certainly not in the evidence of Eusebius, to induce us to believe that they are a spurious addition to St. Mark's Gospel. And then he goes on to consider Jerome, and says that Jerome is just quoting from Eusebius, and is not giving his opinion at all. But what did we read in Martin? What do we read in Metzger? We read that Jerome is giving his opinion. No, he's not. He's giving Eusebius' opinion. We read that Eusebius is giving his opinion. Well, Bergen shows very clearly that this is not Eusebius' opinion. This is the opinion of somebody else that Eusebius is reporting, not that Eusebius is agreeing with. And besides that, of course, you have these many earlier fathers that Bergen reproduces here that show that whatever Eusebius thought or didn't think, these verses should be accepted. In fact, on page 127, Bergen says, the fathers are, in fact, constantly observed to make critical remarks about the ancient copies which simply cannot be correct. So the fathers are not good textual critics, and when they say that certain versions don't have something in, you need to be wary of them. They're much better when they are teaching positively, when they were actually expounding verses as the Word of God. They're not very good as textual critics. And Bergen thinks that a lot of this problem comes from Origen, who was the first real textual critic, and of course had some big problems of his own when it came to Orthodox Christian doctrine. What about the difference in style? Well, for this I'm going to quote from Scrivener's plain introduction to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament. This is the third edition, and page 588. Now, by the way, I hope that you can see the modern books on textual criticism by Alland and by Metzger, which I recommend, by the way, are about 250 pages long. I'm reading a work that is nearly 400 pages long, which deals with just 12 verses. Now, Bergen has got three other volumes, the Revision Revised, Causes of Corruption in the New Testament, and the Traditional Text of the Gospels, I believe it's called, which you should also look at. Revision Revised is 500 pages long. Here's Scrivener, and I'm reading from page 588 of his 650 or 700 page work. And here's the quote. With regard to the argument against these 12 verses arising from their alleged difference in style from the rest of the gospel, I must say that the same process might be applied, and has been applied, to prove that St. Paul was not the writer of the pastoral epistles, St. John of the Apocalypse, Isaiah and Zechariah of portions of those prophecies that bear their names. Everyone used to literary composition may detect, if he will, such minute variations as have been made so much of in this case. And there he refers people to Broadus's essay in the Baptist Quarterly of July 1869, which deals with this. Here, you see, you've got Scrivener, who's one of the great textual critics of all time, who says, well, look, you can't just do that with Mark's gospel, because this is what critics do to get rid of Paul's authorship of the pastoral epistles. And yet there are many evangelicals who hold that Paul wrote the pastoral epistles, and they're not bothered by the difference in style. Now, Bergen, of course, addresses all of this. He addresses all of the differences in style and shows that that is indeed not necessarily the case. And just to finish here, Bergen on page 327, if I can quickly turn there, has this to say. If the original Gospel of St. Mark had been such an incomplete work as is feigned, the fact would have been notorious from the first, and must needs have become the subject of general comment. It may be regarded as certain that so extraordinary a circumstance would have been largely remarked upon by the ancients, and that evidence of the fact would have survived in 100 quarters. It is, I repeat, simply incredible that tradition would have proved so utterly neglectful of her office as to remain quite silent on such a subject, if the facts had been such as are imagined. Either Papias, or else John the Presbyter, Justin Martyr, or Hegesippus, or one of the senators apud Arenium, Clemens Alexandrinus, or Tertullian, or Hippolytus, if not Origen, if not Eusebius, yet certainly Jerome. Some early writer, I say, must certainly have recorded the tradition that St. Mark's Gospel, as it came from the hands of its inspired author, was an incomplete or unfinished work. The silence of the ancients, joined to the inherent improbability of the conjecture, is enough, I submit, in the entire absence of evidence on the other side, to establish the very contradictory of the alternative with which critics are so strenuous in recommending to our acceptance. And then he says here, but on the contrary, we have indirect yet convincing testimony that the oldest copies of all did contain the verses in question. While so far are any of the writers just now enumerated from recording that these verses were absent from the early copies, that 5 out of those 10 fathers actually quote, or else refer to the verses in question in a way that shows that in their day the recognized termination of St. Mark's Gospel, end quote. I wish I could share more of this with you, but I hope at least I've given you something to counterbalance what you are going to be taught, what you may already have been taught if you've been to seminary, or what you may read in modern books of textual criticism or modern commentaries on Mark's Gospel. Certainly, the last 12 verses of Mark, I think, should be given the benefit of the doubt.